Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for January 19th, 2009, and on this week's episode, Ann Nicholson Weber interviews three noted Chicago scenic designers, Todd Rosenthal, Jack McGaw, and Brian Sidney Bembridge. Also, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready, Chicago! And let's talk theater.
Hello, you're listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. I'm your host, Ann Nicholson Weber, and I'm here today with Todd Rosenthal, Jack McGaw, and Brian Sidney Bembridge, all of whom are Chicago-based freelance scenic designers. Jack and Todd also teach. Jack is at DePaul, and Todd is at Northwestern. And we're here to talk about scenic design. So welcome to you all. I thought I might start by asking if there's a way that each of you can characterize your style, why a director might turn to you for a particular show. And maybe, Jack, you could start us off?
Well, I think that I don't think that I really have a style because I have to do so many different things over the course of a year. I mean, I do Shakespeare, I do musicals, I do realistic plays, I do plays that are very abstracted. Sometimes at some theaters, you know, I'll do a realistic set, and then it seems like every time I get asked to go back there, it's for a realistic set.
Mm-hmm. So kind of typecasting.
You start to feel a little pigeonholed to that. But then I go to the next theater and I do, you know, an abstract set, and then the next show I do there is an abstract set. So then mm-hmm. I, you know, so, but
we hope people talk to each other.
Right. But I think our job is to be able to do all of it really well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think the style is in the process, is how I get to the final product is where the style lies.
So your way of interacting with the director and
the other people involved. The way that I, you know, how I start the project, how I talk to the director, how I get it open, mm-hmm. you know, through tech, that tends to be the more constant thing.
And that's what someone chooses when they choose to work.
You serve the text.
With.
I mean, what we do is to do visually what the play needs, not the idea that the visual idea that we want to put out.
Not the Jack McGaw thing, whatever
yeah.
that
no.
isn't.
No.
Right?
It's not about me. It's about the text.
Right. Would you agree with that, Tom?
Yeah, I do agree, and I think in terms of an aesthetic style of my design, I think as a designer, you make so many different choices that are responses to the text, that are responses to requests from the director, that are, you know, that you're responding to the needs of the actors or whatever. And maybe those individual choices have a style, and what they add up to, I think, to me, it seems different every time.
Mm-hmm. So it's very, very different from a painter going into a studio and making something lovely with a, you know, given a theme and making mm-hmm. a painting. It's nothing like that.
Well, I mean, no, there are designers who have a very painterly style.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'm particular. I think early on, I think that my research and my process is more about space than it is about painting.
Well, it's also interesting that you can look at, like, if you looked at, like, the last 15 or 20 designs that I've done, you might see some repeating things, you know, mm-hmm. like I got interested in circles or something. But that changes too over
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of it is very personal. You know, it's like what you're feeling at the moment.
Well, maybe you could talk more then about what that process is, because I think most of us who go to the theater are very vague about how, when the design process begins, who's in charge of it? You know, how much does the director say, I want this? So what's the nature of the collaboration? And Brian, maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think it changes. Every director has a different process. And sometimes your process has to adjust to that director's process. Some directors come in with a metaphor or a word or some sort of visual vocabulary, while other ones say, read it and tell me what you think. So mm-hmm. you have to be able to shift to that.
Mm-hmm.
I often just read the script and scribble in the the sides. It's funny now because, I don't know, I think you guys get a lot of scripts via email, PDFs, then you have to print those. I like to read it on paper, which is not very environmental, but
right.
So that way you can doodle in the margins or circle things and cross things out or highlight, you know, important things. Some directors I work with retype the script and take out all description so that you start from a clean slate, just the words that the actors say, which is kind of cool.
So things that the playwright labored over.
Well, yeah. but oftentimes, too, the stage directions are not from the playwright. They're based on the original
first production.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
They're out of the stage manager's prompt book.
Well, then certainly you're not bound by what the first director may have thought. Being married to a playwright, if you know, to the extent that the playwright put them there, I would think they ought
well,
to
go
into your
Well, sometimes they're so
process.
Dated as well, like those, you know.
Right, Ibsen.
The words
something.
Still
right.
speak to you today, but the direction or the, you know, the notes are so dated.
Because we don't have a proscenium theater practically.
Or you might be in a space, like, you know, we did a show where it's like, oh, well, does it have to be in two locations? You mm-hmm. know, why can't this all take place outside on the porch, you
mm-hmm,
know?
Mm-hmm.
Bill Brown does that quite a bit. You know, it's...
Reconceives.
Yeah, well, there's a... Sometimes it's economy of the theater, it's location, you know... If you don't have any flies, if you don't have anywhere to put scenery, if you don't have, you know, how can we reinvent this to work to the best of our ability?
And oftentimes the transitions are disruptive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you can't do them fluidly, then they just interfere with the playing. What's interesting is that I heard Ann Bogart once talking about the director-designer relationship. And she mm-hmm. said that there's directors and any artist in the theater, directors and designers, they're either beginners, middlers, or enders.
Uh-huh.
Like some directors are really strong beginners, but they kind of fade toward the end. And there's some directors who start really strong and kind of, you know, I mean, at some point you have to remain constant. But I know directors who are very, very strong at the beginning and are less.
And you're talking about the beginning of the play or the beginning of the rehearsal process?
Uh-huh. No, even before the rehearsal.
Right, the beginning of the right,
like I
production
work
process.
With directors who bring nothing to the table.
Mm-hmm.
They're just like, you give me something and I'll run.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And which is more fun to do?
I think both of them are
can work either way.
Yeah, because sometimes it's like it's great at the very beginning because that's really an energetic process between you and the director, and you're going through models, and you're changing your mind, and you're going down this avenue and swerving and turning down another avenue, and so that can be really energetic. What's also great too is you give a really good stage director an idea, and they just do some things with it that you never imagined.
Mm-hmm.
So it's both.
Well, we were talking before the interview began about how the scene interacts with the blocking. And, of course, as I understand it, the scene, the design all happens before the actors maybe are even cast, much less turn up to rehearse. And so, but then eventually this design that you've created has to be used by actors moving around it. So how much do you anticipate... You know, reading the text, okay, if I was the director at the end of this play, I would want someone up high, so I need to give them a place to put someone high, or not. How much are you thinking about that as you design?
I mean, when I read it, I see it on a stage.
So basically, you block it in your mind.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yes. And I don't really... Yeah, I mean, and it's also not as concrete as that either. It's also just a feeling of, at the end, this person needs to be, you know, in a certain place on the stage, mm-hmm. whether it's center or over here or over there. And I mean, it's part of the process is sort of discovering that, whether that's what the director is thinking as well,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, where the actors are on the stage is in my mind at the very beginning.
Well, Todd, you said earlier that you think more architecturally than painterly. What are you doing to create emotion for an audience using space? Can you give a concrete example, for instance, from you recently designed August Osage County? Is there something you can talk about as an example of what that means?
Yeah, I think initially when we started working on August, it was Tracy Letts wanted a 9-room house. He wanted it to be very, very realistic. And for him, it was very much kind of, he wanted to ground these people in a very real world that the audience would respond to.
Mm-hmm.
So that design transitioned to something that was a little more abstract. We still used the height and the the scale of the house was important because it gave a sense of permanency to the house. It also kind of dwarfed the characters in a way that I thought was really kind of appropriate for the piece. And, we started pulling elements away from that, and what resulted was this kind of skeletal dollhouse, which actually worked in another way thematically with the play.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you had this kind of gothic house, yet it was treated in a kind of a whimsical way, and that kind of dichotomy was really interesting. You know, so that type of thing. I mean,
what made it feel like a dollhouse, just really specifically?
I think the wallpaper did. Mm-hmm. I think that the really thin elements of that were holding the house up, we tried to make that look as fragile as possible.
Mm-hmm. So you really felt like you saw the cutaway of something made of
very
thin.
The shape and the scale, and I mean,
like a human ant farm.
Right. And I think being able to see the multiple rooms gave a sense of all these different lives happening simultaneously, sometimes intersecting, sometimes not, but in sort of cells.
And the idea of the dollhouse really was when we moved it to New York, we were actually able to get to make the structure of the house even thinner and more fragile, so that sense of a dollhouse brought even more into focus.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we moved it to London, even more so, we were able to get that fragile structure.
Do you rebuild it every time? You just start from scratch?
I don't build anything.
I mean, someone rebuilt it.
It was rebuilt.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, maybe you could talk about, when you're talking to a director about your ideas, how do you present them? What's your language for presenting visual ideas to a director, Brian?
Well, again, that sort of ranges. I think our research comes from all kinds of different things. It comes from, you know, magazines or books or online, or your walk down the street and you see this A-frame of a house that you think is really cool, or this decorative element somewhere. So it's a collage of stuff. I think what Jack said, it's very personal, so it depends on a lot of it on the mood you're in at the time or how you're feeling and sort of how that relates to the play, I think. It is pretty personal.
But then are you, I mean, just really concretely, you sitting at a table with the director, what are you showing him?
I work a little differently. I do the images first, usually. Some doodles on the script we talk about and maybe a ground plan of the space and look at things. Then I usually go right to rough model. Lots of designers do sketches, beautiful sketches, but I just go to rough shapes, or it depends on how far along we are in the process, but something that we can pull apart and tear. I was the first time I worked with Bill Brown, I brought this model in, and he's like, well, you know, I don't know. So I took it and ripped it in half, and he was like, what are you doing? And I said,
What's it made of?
It's just paper and cardboard and, you know, illustration board, and sometimes there's color on it. Sometimes, like, that had a balsa wood floor and things like that, but I just like being able to play in 3D with a director so they can see spatial relationships.
Do you all use models? Is that what everybody does?
Yeah, I in graduate school, it's all sketches. And I just found that sketches can lie.
Yeah, that's
You know, and directors,
you can get away with a lot.
The directors need to be able to look at it from the front and from the side and stick their face in there and reach in and change things. And so I find models to be much more useful. I start with sketches just for me, just to start exploring space.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as possible. And what Brian's talking about is great, being in the room with the director, and it's more like a three-dimensional sketch than it is a model.
Mm-hmm.
You change things and rip things out and say, what about this size? And you'll do a really quick drawing and stick it in there, and the director goes, oh, I think that's better. And so at the end of the meeting, you have this thing that doesn't mean anything to anybody else but you.
Right, it's like a doodle, a three-dimensional doodle.
And then
you
go back to your studio, and you take that little scrap of thing you crunched up, and you're putting a scale rule to it, and you're
and sometimes you're like, I think this did this. Did he like that part?
And there'll be little notes on the model piece.
Which you can't read anymore. Jack, you recently did The Picnic at Writers Theater, which I thought the scenic design was just a huge element of that show. And for me, the effect of it was maybe more than any other theater space I've ever been in. I felt part of the action. So my first question is, was that intentional? And my second question is, what in the text, if so, what in the text drove that? And the third is, how do you do it?
You just got lucky.
I got lucky. The answer is sort of. Because at that theater, for a long time, I like when the first show I did up there was, the subject was roses several years ago, and I felt like there needed to be a separation between the audience and the action on stage, which is really the style of that play. And the more I worked up there, the more I sort of loosened up about that mantra that I had in my head, where it really became okay in my mind to sort of put the audience right in on top of it. And where that worked the first time was in Bus Stop several years ago. And but that was also still sort of following the architecture of the room and not manipulating the seating or anything. And the other thing is that my background has been in sculptural design. I learned to design in three-dimensional flexible spaces. You know, I didn't encounter a proscenium theater until, you know, 5 or 10 years into my work as a designer. I had always worked in flexible spaces.
Partly because that's where low rent companies work.
I went to Vanderbilt University, and they have a very flexible black box theater down there, so, and that's where I learned, and then I taught there for quite some time too. So when David Cromer said to me, "I want to rearrange the space," I was like, "No problem. You know, we can do that as long." And I did this at Pegasus several years ago, where I turned Pegasus into a thrust theater, and everybody's all excited about that, and it really wasn't that difficult for me, you know, but it did radically sort of alter the architecture and how you relate to the play.
I have the impression, and I can't really, I'm not a very visual person, so I just can remember how I felt, not what it was I saw, but I have the impression that there was something over my head that was also over the stage. Is that right? Was there, were there trees?
Yeah, there were branches.
That's right.
You know, and that was, I mean, David is very detail-oriented and very clear about certain elements. And the branches were a very, something that he talked about from the very first meeting. And the thing that I talked about from the very first meeting was the fact that I thought that the houses needed to be, you know, opposite from each other and not next to each other. And the space, the architectural space, wants things to be next to each other and not on an axis.
So you went against something that the space might have dictated.
Well, sort of. I mean, it was okay with the space.
But you had to overcome something to do it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, well, the most difficult thing was is that when the house was out in the audience, it needed to be skeletal so people could see through it. Yet the one upstage wanted to be more solid and sort of dealing with the stylistic differences between those two houses and making sure that they were in the same design world, but that was the biggest challenge.
And what are the things you can do that? How did you tie them to each other?
Just common elements, like the way that the porches were built was pretty much the same, and having certain details that worked for both things.
No, I thought that was a lovely success. I wonder, Todd, since August was such a, I mean, there's not even a hit
tsunami.
Doesn't begin to, exactly. What do we say? Big deal. I would like to talk a little more about it. And maybe you could talk about what it's like to take the same show from one space to another and then to another, New York and then London.
What was interesting about New York was that we moved from Steppenwolf, which is a brutalist architecture. It's this concrete.
Did you say brutalist?
Brutalist. That's the style of them.
I never heard that.
Concrete. Is that in their bio?
Block.
The brutalist. Well, I know it because my theater in college was brutalist. Very fashionable in the 60s and 70s.
The National kind of is too, isn't it?
National was brutalist.
Yeah, right.
In the National Theater in London. But when we moved it to New York, you have that very ornate frame and that very kind of. And we moved it to the Imperial. It's kind of a gaudy looking, kind of high Baroque, you know, lots of frou-frou. That made a very different picture. It was kind of this twisted family portrait against this very ornate frame, which made it very kind of interesting. But then when we moved it to London and at the Littleton Theater, which is very simple frame yet again, but a much larger frame. And we were able to create this very substantial void. So this house kind of floated in this void without any interference from any frame or anything. And that really was, there was a stillness to it that was really eerie and worked really well. And then the house kind of glowed in this void, which was terrific because we were able to do the entire void out of hard flats covered in black wall. So it was a total void.
Because they just absorbed all the light.
Yeah, it was so black it almost hurt your eyes. It was really amazing.
So was it very, very different? Or was it kind of like what we saw in Chicago but modified?
Well, the thing about the Chicago production is that we were so under the gun. And we designed that thing so quickly. And my assistants and I were just cranking it out.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some things that they had to do structurally because of the time constraints and the money restraints and there's actually some problems with the floor at Steppenwolf that is not as solid as it should be.
Mm-hmm. So you have to worry about weight, literally.
Yeah. So we had to make some choices that we didn't want to make for structural reasons. Mm-hmm. We had to bulk up a lot some of the structure and add some components and change the masking. So when we moved to New York, we were able to kind of strip away all the stuff that we didn't want.
That was makeshift essentially.
Well, Russell, the tedious Steppenwolf did an incredible job in a short amount of time, but with more money and able to
more time,
mm-hmm. we were able to actually get the image that we really wanted. Then we moved to London even more so. We were able to.
Well, and I imagine your understanding of the play would have changed over that time too. Did having lived with it for the entire Chicago run, and I imagine you knew it better. Is that true or no? When you were designing.
I've seen the show so many times, I don't even know.
Where you were when you...
Yeah.
I mean, I just wonder if you had insights over the course of the Chicago run that somehow informed what you did in New York or in London.
Well, what we did do when we moved to New York was we made the set a little smaller. Mm-hmm. I just thought some of the scenes in the bedroom, those scenes in the bedroom were too far away.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that we were able to, by bringing it down a little bit, we were able to make the space a little more combustible. To make any sense,
when you say too far away, you mean because they were too high, so they're literally a greater distance from the audience.
Too high, and I thought the volume of the space was a little too large. And when you work in models, and then you take that model and you make it really big, that's an incredible change of scale. And sometimes the proportions change just because of the physics of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense?
Sure, and well, visually, you're just the angle, of course, changes so much. And that's something I guess you have to think about is. The angle of view from an entire audience, how do you adjust for that? What do you do? Any of you can grab this one.
Well, it's always I think that's a challenge downstairs at Steppenwolf because it's such a wide... I mean, theaters have such a wide seating.
Mm-hmm.
Those seats at the end, they sell them, especially at Steppenwolf. So sometimes you come up with this design and you love it and it's great and you're like, oh, but wait...
They can't see.
These 10 people on either side can't see, so it's always, you can angle walls. There's like simple little tricks like that, or you can get rid of walls. like Osage, there were no walls downstage. There were just a door frame and some things.
Mm-hmm.
But you knew it was a room.
Right.
Right.
Well, before the interview again, you were talking about how in a time of reduced resources, you're often needing to design and anticipate even more so that you'll be designing with less. How does that affect what you do? Jack?
I get all the hard questions. not much. I mean, I really haven't noticed that I'm consciously thinking about, we're in a recession and I need to think about scaling things back because the theaters give me a number and it's really just a number in my mind. I mean, I do what I think is appropriate for the play and I'm not one of those people that tends to overdo things, so usually I'm okay with the budget. Then I'll do one that's way, way over, and I have to, and that's good because then, you learn pretty quickly that you have to cut some elements, and usually that makes it better.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can get past the idea that cutting things is going to hurt the design or hurt the production, then usually you end up with something better. It means you have to do more work to get there, but oftentimes you're going to end up with something that's much more satisfying visually.
It's hard to design to a number. Like,
you can't.
We just do what we do.
Numbers
we
don't
just
mean
do, yeah.
They don't mean anything to us.
I don't even know what that means.
They just say we got to we got to cut something or change something.
I mean, I understand how to build scenery. I did it for a long time, and most of us have, and I've painted, and I've done all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I haven't looked up what a sheet of plywood costs in 15 years. Right. You know,
and different theaters have that number means something different.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you work at the Arena Stage, if you work at Steppenwolf, if you work at the Goodman, you work at wherever, they're able to pull off different, you know.
They have different strengths, or they order mm-hmm. their lumber in, you know, bulk.
I have the oddest thing in Pittsburgh this year.
Well, they have a resident sculptor who built everything. You know,
where the set, he called me up and he said, the set is like costing twice as much as we have budgeted, but don't worry about it. I'll call you back. And in a couple of days, he calls me back and said, we're good to go. I'm like, what did you do? He said, that's the way we do it. I always inflate the numbers. We present it. They want to keep the design, so they figure out how to do it.
Is he going to wish that you hadn't?
I know.
I used to work.
The secret's out.
I used to work with David Petrarca, this wonderful director, and he had this thing. I think it's. I heard it referenced as flaming monkeys or flaming elephants, but he would always add an element that he called flaming monkeys. Yeah. And there was something that he really didn't need or didn't want, but it was hugely expensive and hugely elaborate. And then when it got to the meeting where you had to cut things, he said, okay, listen, I'll cut the flaming monkeys.
I love this, but I'll cut it.
Yeah. And if I cut the flaming monkeys, I can't cut this.
Right. Yeah. I've given all I can give.
Yeah.
Well, we learned to design and put the flaming monkeys in, uh-huh. you know, because I always have – things that I know I can cut that aren't going to change the integrity of the design.
But and also thematically too, I think that we are more often than not designing not just a set, we're designing vocabulary. We're designing a place, a space that can change and be flexible, and so that God forbid an actor had an idea, or maybe the director has an idea in rehearsal, so that you can actually modulate things within the design to accommodate the needs of the production. And also to accommodate the resources of the production, you can actually lose an element here and there and not compromise the overall.
Well, and you were talking about design. Like blocking in the space, and I think that changes director to director too. Sometimes I just give an open space or whatever it is, and we know we need a table and chairs, and then that has to go away, and we know we need a TV and a sofa or something. But I give them the elements, and the directors will play in the space and figure that out.
So you don't say it's going to be here.
No,
downstage,
I mean,
right.
But some directors, you just figure out those relationships. You mm-hmm. do more of what Jack said. Mm-hmm. And it depends, you know, like if the set's turning or, you know, there's all kinds of elements in it. But again, the cool thing, I think why we love doing what we do is because it's something different every time. It's a different experience.
And there's so much flexibility in what he's talking about in terms of this open space,
mm-hmm.
this kind of open landscape for the play to happen. It's like, it's refreshing sometimes just to see that.
So you're saying, though, that you consciously, as you're designing, create something that if it needs to be modified during rehearsal, can be.
Oh,
And what do you? What is that? What does that mean? How do you make something more flexible? Is it materials? Is it structure? What is it?
I don't know.
Well, I'm doing it like, so Po' Boy Tango opens tonight at Northlight.
Yeah.
The director and I and the lighting designer had these conversations via email and photos and stuff. He got into rehearsal and realized, oh, this angle isn't the best angle. Let's move this counter over here. And mm-hmm. he has the freedom to do that because mm-hmm. it was sort of an open space.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final moment is this sort of big wall opening up, which sort of goes back to your other question. Originally, it was supposed to be this frame stayed in the wall behind it tracked away. So it was a big sort of open framework. But because of budgetary reasons, we had which became sort of this great, beautiful, open, sort of zen world then. But the Che would move the counters and the table cart to wherever he needed to work for that apartment. So mm-hmm. there were three different locations in it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I mean, there hasn't been a play that I haven't walked in when they finally got it all assembled on the stage. And I've moved furniture and changed rugs out and go, oh, that was a really bad idea.
What was I thinking?
But the thing is that you design it in a way that you allow yourself to change.
You're not locked
those
in.
Elements. Yeah.
Right. I did this production down in Philadelphia, and when I was in grad school, you glued everything down. You built this beautiful, pristine model, you glued all the furniture in it, and then you shipped it off, and it was all perfect. And the model, I got a call from the director in Philly, and he said, you glued all the furniture down. I said, yeah. I said, don't ever do that again.
Lesson learned. Right.
Okay. Well, Jack and I just did he was just talking about the show in Pittsburgh. And I led the show. So, and there were some great changes made, like between you and Ron, the director, when we got there. Like simple little things that made like the downstage area better. Or like he added all these details that...
Well, here's the thing.
The actors could use, and it was,
The Pittsburgh stage is a lot like Chicago Shakespeare. It's really deep and really narrow, mm-hmm. and we were trying to do a realistic set mm-hmm. in that. And I hadn't ever seen the theater, and I hadn't seen any scenery in that theater until I showed up, and mine was in the theater. So when I walked in the room, I knew immediately what was wrong, mm-hmm. that I needed some stuff downstage, and then we needed to fix some things because I had this big tongue of scenery sticking out into the audience that didn't make any sense with the rest of what was going on. So
once you see it in the space, yeah. Well, we're almost out of time, but one last thing I'd like to talk about is the relationship between the set and the lighting. And I imagine that your set, well, and Brian, of course, does both, but I imagine that your set can look incredibly different depending on how it's lit. How much input do you have into the lighting design, and have you ever felt like someone wrecked it, or I don't know what. Talk a little bit about that interaction.
I used to do lighting a lot, actually.
Uh-huh, so you've done that too.
As well, I haven't lately because the schedule is so different that it's hard to do both.
Because you do all the lighting at the end.
And when you start doing scenic design after scenic designer, you're working on a certain schedule, and when you throw lighting design in on top of that, it's difficult. But I'm very sensitive to that because mm-hmm. I actually showed up to graduate school to be a lighting designer, and they announced me as a scenic designer, so I went with it.
Said, oh, okay.
but it's the two go hand in hand with me, and it can make or break it. You know, mm-hmm. And I'm very forward with lighting designers about things, and sometimes that's okay, and sometimes it's not.
Some listen and some don't. Uh-huh.
No, I think that a really, really healthy collaboration involved the lighting designer from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing a show now, Magnolia at the Goodman, with Jim Engels, who's this wonderful lighting designer. And what he'll do is he'll take the drawings, go away, and he'll look at them in detail, and look at all the model photos and everything. Then he'll give you a whole list of questions. He'll say, in order for me to do this, I need this to happen. And he does it in a very collaborative way. He's not dictating to you. Mm-hmm. And then when you respond to them, so when you're in the theater, you're all on the same page.
Can you give an example of what a lighting designer would need from you to allow something to happen that he has in his head?
Like, for instance, there's this huge tree drop upstage. It's a painting of a tree. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't enough room up there for him to actually to accommodate the ideas that he had about lighting that. So we moved mm-hmm. that. And then we moved some of the other elements. There's a big roof piece that flies in. And he wanted to put some texture on that, so we had to move that to accommodate those things. Sometimes there are color ideas from the lighting designer. I just remember a number of years ago going to the Alley Theater in Texas and meeting the lighting designer for the first time on the first day of tech. And I can just tell you how that collaboration.
That's not ideal, no. I gather. Well, I imagine you talked about having that black wool at the National that would just completely absorb light. I imagine that materials choices you make impact a lot what the lighting designer can do. So do you think about that? Are you, again, like just as you said, you have to some degree, you direct the play in terms of blocking. Do you design it in terms of lighting as you're designing the set?
Yeah, always. There's a designer I work with, Charlie Cooper, quite often, who laughs me all the time because I'm like, oh, look, or Jesse Klug, I left space for booms. We can put booms in there. Uh-huh. Like telling them we might have to use booms in the show, and they always laugh me and often cut the booms, but
Jim just had me cut the booms. He said, what are those booms for? I said, I don't know.
Wouldn't that be good?
Them. I know. Get them off the drawing.
I do that as well.
Well, we are unfortunately out of time. I have the feeling we could go for a while bit, but thank you so much for joining me. It was a great pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of January 19th, 2009. The Prague Shakespeare Festival and the Mermaid Theatre Company will present a new one-man show of Shakespeare's Hamlet by Prague Shakespeare's artistic director Guy Roberts. This American premiere will be held here in Chicago at the Gorilla Tango Theatre and runs from February 6th through the 15th. This is all in preparation for a European premiere that is coming this May. Guy Roberts is one man, 18 characters, and 90 minutes. It's a tour de force one-man presentation of Hamlet with unique insights into the mind of Shakespeare's greatest and most famous character. Prague's only professional English-language classical theater company reinvents the tragedy of Denmark's Sweet Prince and continues to challenge and inspire audiences alike. Hamlet will run at the Gorilla Tango Theater this February 6th through the 15th. To find out how to purchase tickets, click on over to theaterinchicago.com. Writers Theatre announces Old Glory, a world premiere production commissioned from Brett Nevue, one of Chicago's hottest young playwrights, through the Writers Theatre Literary Development Initiative. Old Glory is part three of Nevue's three-play series, Trilogy 04-05-06. Part one was Harmless and part two was Weapon of Mass Impact. The play follows the circumstances surrounding six ordinary people grappling with the emotional casualties of war in a play that explores with fierce wit and gritty honesty what happens when you play by the rules and lose. The world premiere production of Brett Nevue's Old Glory will be directed by William Brown and will run from February 3rd through March 29th at Writers Theatre in Glencoe. Tickets are currently available. Click on over to our website for the details. Tickets for Looking Glass Theatre Company's production of Our Town went on sale to the public last Friday. The production will star David Schwimmer playing the role of George Gibbs in this American classic masterpiece, which runs from February 11th through April 5th in the historic Water Tower Works. Our Town also features Laura Eason, David Catlin, Heidi Stillman, and Andrew White. To buy tickets, follow the information at theaterinchicago.com's Theatre News section. Steppenwolf Theatre presents the Matinee series, an affordable way for high school students to see Steppenwolf productions and meet professional Chicago artists and connect with other teens who are passionate about theater. The lineup of plays includes The Seafarer, Art, Of Mice and Men, The Tempest, and more. Students should mention Matinee to receive their discount tickets. For more information, check out the article in our news section. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. Remember, you can find us here every Monday with more news ready for you to enjoy. So, until next Monday, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago, and I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Todd Rosenthal, Jack McGaw, and Brian Sidney Bembridge for giving us the honor of interviewing them this week. I would also like to thank Ann Nicholson Weber and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And also, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we will be here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.